Somalia ushers in a new era. After a bitter power struggle and a long-delayed presidential election, delivering a comeback for former President Hassan Sheikh Mohamed. But he faces chronic economic, political and security challenges. Who really wields power in Somalia? Is Mohamed the right man for the job? What will he do differently this time? And what is at stake for the future of the Horn of Africa nation? Also, is social media poisoning politics ahead of crucial elections in Kenya and the DRC? Influencers are renting out their pages and platforms to political candidates. Smart campaign strategy or disinformation super spreaders? We'll discuss where digital rights end and digital responsibility begins. Straight Talk Africa starts now. Hello there and welcome. I'm Heidi Adams. Thank you so much for joining me. A Somalia at peace with itself and the world. That is what the East African nation's new president, Hassan Sheikh Mohamed, says he wants for his country. Mohamed is the first leader in the country's history to be elected twice as president. He now has a lot of serious issues on his plate, including a devastating drought, soaring inflation, deep political grievances, and of course the fight against Al-Shabaab insurgents who have been trying to overthrow the government there for more than a decade. However, Mohamed has been here before. VOA's Paul Ndiro looks at what awaits the Somali president and his people.
After a marathon poll involving 36 candidates and perhaps one of the most transparent elections ever broadcast live on state TV, parliamentary officials counted 214 votes in favor of former President Hassan Sheikh Mohamud, far more than the number required to defeat incumbent President Mohamed Abdullahi Mohamed, better known as Farmajo. Mohamud was previously president from 2012 to 2017. He was sworn in shortly after the votes were counted. He immediately extended an olive branch as he addressed the country.
Let us think about tomorrow and not yesterday and what happened. I will work on a brilliant tomorrow and a beautiful future for the sake of my people to live with dignity in the world. I will implement my motto, Somalia at peace with itself and with the world.
Somalia's 15 million people have endured civil war and clan battles with no strong central government since the dictator Muhammad Siad Barre was toppled in 1991. Now, Mohamud again faces a daunting task of tackling drought, hunger, and a seemingly never-ending conflict against the Islamist terrorist group Al-Shabaab. Celebratory gunfire erupted in Mogadishu, with many hoping that the presidential vote highlighted a political crisis that has lasted well over a year after Farmajo's term ended in February 2021. Somalia has not held a universal suffrage vote in 50 years. Instead, polls follow a complex indirect model where state legislatures and clan delegates pick lawmakers for the national parliament who then elect the president. Samira Said, executive director of the Mogadishu-based think tank, said that familiar names would enjoy an advantage in the polls ahead of the election.
People are looking for more familiar candidates and not any newbies, people who have not governed or do not understand the Somali context. So for sure, this will be a change. People will not go for a new face. They will definitely go for old faces, people that they recognize, people that they feel they're more comfortable with.
President Hassan Sheikh Mohamud is the first Somali president to win a second term, and he is promising to transform Somalia into a peaceful country. He will also need to repair the damage caused by months of political chaos and infighting both at the executive and between the central government and state authorities. Earlier this month, an attack on an African Union-based killed 10 Burundian peacekeepers, according to Burundi's army. It was the deadliest raid on AU forces in the country since 2015. The Al-Qaeda-linked insurgents controlled Mogadishu until 2011, when African Union forces pushed them out, but insurgents still held territory in the countryside. Paul Ndiho, VOA News, Washington.
Now, is Hassan Sheikh Mohamed the right man for the job at this moment in his country's history? Somalia has had a taste of his leadership before. So what will he do this time that he didn't do the last time he was in office? Now, to discuss this with me here in studio is Haroon Maarouf. He is a senior editor with VOA's Somali News Service. And also joining us is Omar Mahmoud, a senior analyst for Somalia with the International Crisis Group. He joins us via Skype from the Mozambican capital of Maputo. Gentlemen, welcome to Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you.
Haroon, can you start us off here? And for people who are outside of the Somali context, who exactly is Hassan Sheikh Mohamed? I have many questions about him, but I also want to know who are his supporters, why do they back him, and who are his critics, and what do they say about him?
Those are very interesting questions. Thanks for having me. Hassan Sheikh Mohamed is his background is a civil society activist. He was born in the town of Jalalaksi in central Somalia in 1955. He has been involved in civil activism in Somalia after the collapse of the former government in 1991. That's when the civil war started in Somalia. There were fighting between the Kalanis and between the warlords. And as a result of that fighting, Mogadishu nearly collapsed. There was heavy fighting. And then Somalis needed civil activists, elders, community workers to come out of the shadow and pacify the communities and remove the roadblocks from the green line. Hassan Sheikh Mohamed was one of those. That's how he got his early popularity as a civil activist. And then after that, in 1999, he started opening an education institute, because as a result of the civil war, educational centers have collapsed, public services have ceased to exist, and Somalis relied on individuals like Hassan Sheikh Mohamed and private organizations to fill the space vacated or emptied as a result of the lack of the government. And that's how he co-founded the CEDEM Institute, which later on became a university, one of the biggest universities in Mogadishu today, which produces hundreds of students and graduates every year. And he only entered politics in 2011. That's when he launched his political party, the Peace and Development Party. They elected him as chair. The following year, in 2012, Somalia ratified its provisional constitution. It was ratified by 800 delegates collected from throughout the country. And in that year, he also became a parliamentarian, and he competed for the presidential election in August 2012. And in that election, he reached the final round. He contested against the incumbent at the time, former president, Sharif Sheikh Ahmed, and he defeated him. He got most votes by any candidate at the time in a presidential election, 70% of the parliamentarians at the time. This election he won just last week was 65%, slightly lower. So that's how he became president, and that's who Hassan Sheikh Mohamed is. His critics accuse him when he became a president. They accuse him not taking Al-Shabaab very seriously, for failing to remove Al-Shabaab from the country. And they also accuse him for corruption. His government was implicated in the repatriation of assets that Somalia had outside the country. He denies these allegations of corruption. His supporters believe that during his time, and he's credited this with him of making this possible, he established four of the five federal member states that are functioning today. So they believe he is a consensus builder. They believe that he can complete the federal system, and they believe he can reach out to the regions. As you know, last few years, the relationship between the federal government and the regions was strained. There was political dispute over the election, over other issues, and the regions and the federal government never trusted each other. We can discuss that in more detail, but they believe Hassan Sheikh Mohamud, since he was one the founder, the president who built four of these five regions, he can bridge that gap and solve those differences.
Look, from an outsider, that's a respectable resume for sure and a respectable background. Omar, there's a saying, cometh the hour, cometh the man. Is Hassan Sheikh Mohamud the right man for the job? What are the opportunities here for him to show that he is up to the task in this moment?
Yeah, well, I think to start, I think we should actually look at the fact that the electoral process at the end preserved this tradition of power rotation at the highest leadership that was very much accepted all across the board. That was not a given, considering how decisive and really polarizing the entire lead-up to the election had been over the past year and a half. And so that's actually something that President Mahmoud campaigned on. You know, he campaigned on this idea that he can be the reconciler. This is very inherent in the slogans that he used. And I think he struck a chord because the situation had been so polarizing, because it had been so divisive, that you know, he can fulfill this role. And I think that'll be the first challenge, really, right off the beginning. You know, you do have a situation where the previous president replaced some federal member state leaders with others, and those he weren't able to replace really became the ones most opposed to him. And so you had divisions on that front. You had a number of other political divisions within the capital as well. And so I think, you know, the degree of success will hinge on President Mahmoud's ability to actually serve as a reconciler, as he sort of claims. And in that regard, he does have useful success. He has been here before. It is a unique situation where you have a new leader for Somalia, yet one that also has the experience. And I think we saw during his previous administration, that he did undertake a greater degree of consultation than the previous administration has. And in terms of engaging, you know, there was times where he still wanted to push his way, but there was always a more degree of engagement around that.
Harun, what are his main priorities going to be, and what do the people of Somalia expect those priorities to be?
We interviewed him today. And he spoke briefly about his priorities in the first 100 days of his administration. He said he wanted to tackle security of the capital. And by doing that, he said we cannot secure the capital within the capital. He said he wanted to secure the capital from the regions nearby, which indicates that he wants to attack al-Shabaab that still have bases in the regions that are close to the capital, in particular Lower Shabelle region and Middle Shabelle region. Al-Shabaab is very strong in these regions, and they carry out attacks against the government forces, African Union forces. That is where one of the bases that was mentioned in the previous report, located in Middle Shabelle region. That's where the Al-Shabaab just killed earlier this month 30 Burundian soldiers. That's one of his main challenges, is how is he really going to be able to remove Al-Shabaab, or at least degrade, because Al-Shabaab still controls large parts of the country. He also talked about political stability, and I think he's referring to reconciling between the federal government and the regions. This is very important because the government does not have a lot of power. It does not control its own territory, the federal government. Somalia is a federal system. There are five federal states and Mogadishu. So he has to discuss and reach out to the regional leaders so that they can fight together against Al-Shabaab and also bridge their political differences. And why this is important? So that they can complete the constitution, because a big part of the dispute between Somali leaders is the constitution. The constitution is very important for power sharing, it's very important for resource sharing, it's very important for the country to have a stable political system. And that's what he was talking about when he referred to the political stability. He also mentioned it, completing the debt relief process. Somalia has been in a heavy debt for a long time. Originally, it was estimated Somalia owes about $5 billion to foreign creditors. That has been reduced now, but Somalia has to meet the financial requirements set by the World Bank and the IMF, and if they can complete that in the next few years, I think Somalia can reach, can be free of debt. And that's one of the priorities he wanted to focus on, based on the interviews he gave us. But Somalia is also expecting more from him. They wanted the government to earn the trust of the public. One of the challenges that every Somali government faced over the years is not getting enough support from the community, because Al-Shabaab is not an alien organization. It's within the society. So if the public do not effectively work with the government cannot defeat Al-Shabaab. The other main challenge he needs is to reach out Somaliland. Somaliland is still claiming to be separate from Somalia. It wants to be recognized as an independent country. It has not achieved that yet, but it's a task that's waiting Somali leaders as well as Somaliland leaders to reach out an agreement on going forward. The other main task that waits the new president is the election that brought him to power twice was flawed. There were allegations of corruption, irregularities. Ordinary people were not given a chance to vote. He was voted to the post by parliamentarians who were elected in a very dubious process that was highly criticized locally and internationally. Is he able to lead the country to a popular election where people can directly elect their own representatives? That's one of the key demands and requests by the population.
And I want to get you to this very indirect election a little later on, because I want you to explain that some of that to us. Omar, there's political reconciliation, as Harun just said, and of course the need to address the security situation in the country. Which is going to have to come first? Or to what extent does the one depend on the other? Or is Mohammed going to have to walk and chew gum here both at the same time?
Well, I think they're very much interlinked. And, you know, on top of that, I would actually put the humanitarian situation as well, given the drought we've seen occurring in Somalia. This is both a short-term issue in terms of responding to that, but also a long-term one, given that this is the third time in almost about a decade we've seen such a devastating famine, and the climatic indicators aren't that positive going forward either. But when it comes to, you know, politics and security, you know, I do think they're intertwined. You know, political reconciliation is really key, though, because I think the security dynamics flow from political reconciliation. If you have united politics, if you have a Somali elite that has a common vision around that, it's going to be much easier to undertake some of the security dynamics and some of the security reforms. But by political reconciliation, you know, I think one frame is the federal government, federal member state relationship. That's really key. But I also think we need to look within the federal member states themselves. A lot of them have suffered over the past couple years, and particularly through the recent electoral process as well, to the point where many of them are divided entities. And these are the building blocks of the federal government. And so if those aren't coherent structures, then, you know, the building blocks, you know, of the wider government aren't coherent. And so I think there's a need to look into that as well in terms of his political reconciliation agenda. And of course, this all ties into security, because we have to be cognizant of the fact that the new president now inherits a withdrawal plan around the African Union transition mission. You know, that was recently negotiated. It's supposed to run through the end of 2024. Now, of course, that's dependent on conditions on the ground. The biggest condition was it committed the Somali government to developing around 20,000 troops over the next couple of years. And the details of that were left very unclear. And so that's kind of another aspect on the new president's plate, which will be very important in terms of how the security situation is addressed going forward.
And we have all these overlapping challenges, but given the fact that this was, Harun, such a long delayed, bitterly fought election, or just to get to the point, one can't help but see the glaring thing that you just mentioned about the electoral process itself and how problematic that is. A president voted into power with 327 votes. How problematic is that process? And can you take us through the mechanics of how Somalia's election works?
Yeah, it's a very complicated process. You know, when Somalia fell into civil war in 1991, there was civil war and they could not agree on a national unit government. About 30,000 troops were sent to Somalia by international governments, including the United States, to help Somalia. 15 reconciliation conferences were held in and outside Somalia in order to find a government. Finally, in 2000, a reconciliation conference was held in Djibouti, and that's where Somalis, clan elders, some politicians, civil society activists, educators, first time chose and established the transitional national government, which was based on a new power sharing system called 4.5, which means the four main clans in the country are going to take same amount of numbers within the parliament, and 0.5 comprises smaller clans, and they take half of the seats. So that's how the power sharing in Somalia was based on, and that's how Somali parliaments were established, and that's how the Somali parliament elected a president. That's why they call indirect elections. The elders choose the delegates elect the parliamentarians. In 2020, the president, the outgoing president, Mohamed Abdullahi Farmajo, signed an election law. And previously, Somalia has passed on a political party law, which will allow and pave the way for the country to elect representatives based on political parties, so that people can directly elect and vote for the representative rather than clan selecting MPs. But when the president signed this law in February 2020, that was just 10 months before the parliament's mandate was expiring. So the opposition accused the president that he delayed signing the election law. They do not trust him. He wants to extend his mandate, and a dispute started. And then in September 2020, the federal government and the regional leaders agreed, because of the political dispute, to go back to the indirect election and allow the elders and the clan elders to elect the parliamentarians rather than the public voting for them. People were very disappointed because the 4.5 system is very discriminatory. The Somali leadership was dominated by two clans since the country took independence in 1960. More than 60 years, Somalia only had 10 presidents. Hassan Sheikh Mohamud will be the 10th president. And these presidents only came from two clans out of so many clans in Somalia. So the 4.5 system, the clan system, is very discriminatory. It disenfranchises a whole community. And that's why Somalia expected the new president to lead the country to popular elections, so that people can see a fairer system.
Directly. Omar, we've been talking about the relationships inside the country, but what is Mohamud's relationship like with leaders in the region, especially Kenya, Ethiopia, and how is he perceived and regarded on the international stage?
Yeah, well, President Mohamud has been here before, and so he's had relations with these countries in the past. Now, of course, the situation of 5 years ago is not the same as today. You've had very significant changes in the Horn of Africa and very significant upheaval at that same time. You know, during his previous time in power, he did have a close relationship with Ethiopia. This was actually something people criticized at the time of his re-election, that he was seen as too close to Addis Ababa. Now, of course, the ruling party in Addis Ababa at that time is no longer there. And so it remains to be seen how he approaches that relationship. It was almost sort of necessary at that time because Ethiopia also played such a dominant role in Somali politics. But given that Ethiopia is a bit distracted by its internal crises now, it no longer plays that same dynamic. Now, when it comes to Kenya, relations have actually been pretty poor over the past couple years. You know, there's been two periods where there was actually a complete rupture in relations between Nairobi and Mogadishu. And so I think the expectation is that dynamic should improve. But it's not to say that there aren't still fundamental issues of divergence within the Kenya-Somalia relationship that will have to be addressed. It's just to say that it might not be as combative and more consultative. You know, we should remember, for example, President Mahmoud was the one that first submitted this maritime case to the International Court of Justice. You know, there's the disputed boundary between Kenya and Somalia, and they haven't been able to resolve it and kind of submitted it more to the international courts against, you know, the wishes of Kenya. And then that ruling came out last year as well. So there's still some fundamental dynamics in that relationship. But there is an expectation it won't be as confrontational as before, in part because the Farmajo administration prioritized relations within the Horn of Africa, among some other countries, Ethiopia and Eritrea, key among them, and kind of let other relations, including the one with Djibouti as well, wither. And so I think we'll see a change in that dynamic. Of course, Kenya's coming up to an election as well in a couple months, so none of these dynamics are permanent. Now, within kind of international partners, you know, a lot of them have worked with President Mahmoud before, so there's that familiarity. You know, I think that's positive in terms of some relationships, but of course that also comes with some baggage. But I think there's, you know, an idea that having someone experienced in office at this crucial time is quite useful, and I think they see him as someone that they can essentially work with.
Now, just as President Hassan Sheikh Mohammed takes office in Somalia, the United States has announced that it will deploy up to 500 troops to the East African nation. President Joe Biden's decision now reverses a Trump-era withdrawal of about 700 troops who were in Somalia to help local forces fight al-Shabaab. And as VOA's Anita Powell reports, the White House says it's based its decision on a request from Lloyd Austin, who's the U.S. Secretary of Defense. Harun and Omar, I want you to stay with me as we play the story, and we're going to continue our discussion right afterwards.
Somalia's new president will soon see the return of U.S. forces to the Horn of Africa nation. The 500 elite troops are tasked with pushing back al-Shabaab, a violent extremist group that has destabilized Somalia for more than 15 years. Monday's decision reversed the Trump administration's 2020 withdrawal of all 700 troops then in the country.
The decision to reintroduce a small but persistent presence was made first and foremost to maximize the safety and effectiveness of our force and enable them to provide better support of our partners. Additionally, our partners can benefit from our more consistent support and engagement in addressing the threat posed by al-Shabaab by having a small but persistent U.S. military presence. And while there is risk, it is manageable.
White House officials said the troops would come from nearby bases on the continent. Officials did not say where U.S. troops would be positioned, who their targets may be, or how long troops would be in Somalia. U.S. military and counterterrorism officials describe al-Shabaab as al-Qaeda's largest, wealthiest, and deadliest affiliate. They've recently grown in size and become more aggressive, killing at least 30 Burundian soldiers during an attack on an African Union base in southern Somalia earlier this month. The U.S. public has long been wary of involvement in Somalia after the 1993 Battle of Mogadishu resulted in the killing of 18 U.S. service members. The Pentagon defended the decision.
The point is, al-Shabaab remains a threat, and that threat we assess not only continues but is increasing. And we believe this is the best way for us to continue what has remained a very valuable advise and assist and training mission. It's just this is a better way to do it.
It is not clear whether Somalia's new president, who was elected on Sunday, made this request. Somali security analysts say the move is welcome, especially if the U.S. resumes airstrikes against al-Shabaab, but also say that the military solution is not the only one.
The airstrikes were keeping al-Shabaab at bay, but once those airstrikes stopped, we saw a resurgence of the group. The airstrikes and the offensive operations are not the solution. The solution is really a Somali government that really works on this in a coordinated manner that's societal-wide. The problem in Somalia is a political problem. It's political settlements that needed within the elite. It's a clan problem. All of these things need to be resolved. The grievances that push our youth to join al-Shabaab need to be resolved.
It seems no one is safe. In February, a suicide bomber targeted the presidential villa, killing at least six people and wounding more than a dozen. Anita Powell, VOA News, the White House.
Omar, you've joined us for that story. In your assessment, what appears to be the message here from Washington, and how will this announcement of a troop deployment now be interpreted in Mogadishu?
Well, I think the announcement is not that surprising in itself. You know, I think if you look at the nature of the Trump administration's plan to reposition the troops, you know, first of all, they weren't bringing them home. They were just putting them in Kenya and Djibouti nearby and still having them continue some of their programming. And it was never about dynamics on the ground in Somalia. You know, it wasn't an assessment that al-Shabaab was no longer a threat or whatnot. I think it had to do more with his own calculations for his campaigning and sort of his legacy and whatnot. So in that sense, the decision itself isn't surprising. To see them kind of go back in, to continue the programs that they've been doing, but just from afar. Having said that, though, I think the timing is a little unfortunate. You know, it was less than 24 hours after the conclusion of the presidential cycle. And it really reinforces the idea that, you know, the U.S. interest in Somalia is primarily counterterrorism focused. That's always been the criticism of U.S. policy towards Somalia. It's too militaristic. It's too focused on counterterrorism. It doesn't look at the wider picture. And this move would really support that. I mean, this is a move that, yes, can have some pressure on al-Shabaab. And as we heard in the segment, there is support among Somali officials, especially for the airstrike element, in order to maintain that pressure. But that is a containment strategy at its core. That's a tactical gain. It's not something strategic or long-term. It's not dealing with the root causes, which are much more political in nature. And I think there was an opportunity here, given that the U.S. is supposed to be reviewing its Somali policy as well, with a new administration coming in, to kind of announce maybe a bit more of a holistic approach. But instead, and that might still be coming, but instead the first thing we see is this, again, default to a counterterrorism dynamic.
Haroon, we know for a fact, and we always see the visuals, the violence, the bombings, people dying, being maimed by al-Shabaab's reign of terror in the country. But beyond the violence, what kind of power does al-Shabaab really wield in the country, in society and in politics? Can you give us just a little bit of insight into sort of the day-to-day power that they wield?
Yeah, they have a chokehold on the population. They are collecting millions of dollars every year as a taxation from the ordinary public. They even collect tax from areas controlled by the government. The Somali borders are open. They import weapons. They recruit among the Kalanis and from the rural communities. They control most of the rural areas. So every year they are recruiting. They are sophisticating, developing their techniques, their level of explosives, their knowledge in explosives and the level of attacks they carry out are becoming more sophisticated every year. So al-Shabaab is very strong. They outlasted four presidents so far, including Hassan Sheikh Mohamud's first term. Al-Shabaab has been fighting in Somalia for 15 years now. The problem is al-Shabaab is very powerful, but they are powerful because the Somali government and the support of the international community against al-Shabaab is very weak. There has been no coherent, sustained effort to remove al-Shabaab and degrade the group. And they have the opportunity and the time to train their operatives, their leaders. Of course, a number of their leaders were killed by drone strikes, but there were no sustained military operation on the ground to support the air strikes. And so al-Shabaab flourished succeeded in controlling large areas of the country. So they're very powerful. And any government that wants to remove al-Shabaab is not just going to need a military solution. They're going to need military solutions, just one component. Al-Shabaab is in the society. It's an ideological organization. You need to control their finance. You need to fight them ideologically. You need to fight them. Education, their education is that indoctrinates young people. So there are multifaceted approach towards al-Shabaab. That's the only approach to degrading them.
Omar, given al-Shabaab's power, there are questions about whether a new president and a new government even matters. But does Mohamed really have the mettle? Does he have the juice to really build an effective coalition or support politically to really have sort of a unified approach to contain al-Shabaab or fight al-Shabaab? My question, I guess, is just... is it realistic to think he can succeed where other administrations, including his own, have not, and that is to wipe al-Shabaab out?
Well, I don't think al-Shabaab can be defeated militarily. I think that's an assumption that has driven a lot of the policy towards Somalia, especially counterterrorism strategies to date. Increasingly, I think there's a reflection that al-Shabaab is a powerful actor in Somalia, also a governing actor, one that controls most of urban areas, most of rural areas within the country, but has also infiltrated urban areas. And they actually provide also some services that compete with the federal government itself. And so there's this sense that al-Shabaab is a Somali actor, it's embedded in Somali society, and it's not one you are going to conventionally defeat militarily. And so this is where, you know, President Mahmoud's campaign slogans about reconciliation are so important. Al-Shabaab thrives on political grievances and social grievances within Somalia. They're very good about exploiting these to their advantage. And as long as the political elite remain divided, al-Shabaab can take advantage. And really, the electoral cycle was a very good case in point in this. We've seen some very significant al-Shabaab attacks over the past year and a half, including recently the one on a African Union peacekeeping base, which really hadn't been replicated in a number of years. We saw their attacks on the electoral venues and whatnot. The entire government over the past year and a half had been focused more on the electoral dynamic, had been divided around it, and that provides space for a group like al-Shabaab to thrive. So I think it's less looking at the pure military solution. No, I don't think in 4 years we can expect al-Shabaab to be wiped out. I don't think that's really how this conflict ends. Rather, I think it's necessary to continue to make progress to mount sort of political reconciliation so you have more of a united front. And that will begin to weaken the group itself and put it in a position where, you know, eventually at some point there might need to be a negotiated solution as well. And that could lay the groundwork for that.
Well, we'll certainly keep our eye on Mohammed's administration and events going forward in Somalia. Thank you so much, gentlemen. Harun Maruf is a senior editor with VOA's Somali News Service, and Omar Mahmoud is a senior analyst for Somalia with the International Crisis Group. Gentlemen, thank you so much for your time. And we're going to take a short break here, and when Straight Talk Africa returns. With crucial elections set for a number of African countries in coming months, how much of the outcome could be driven by social media? We'll also look at the rise of Kenya's social media influences in election politics. A closer look at all of it after the break.
Health, wellness, sport, beauty, medical breakthroughs. Healthy Living cares about your well-being. What are the main health concerns in Africa and around the world? Find out the latest on coronavirus. Connect with our experts and ask them questions.
How long does the virus stay?
Join me, Lino Khmudu, in Washington, every week on Healthy Living, right here on VOA.
You're with Straight Talk Africa. Welcome back. Around the world, social media has become a powerful battleground in electoral politics. It's a way for political candidates to mobilize their supporters and interact with the electorate. But it's also a very potent vehicle for fake news and disinformation campaigns at a time when trust and truth are of utmost importance. And that online battleground is largely driven by social media influencers. A report by French news agency AFP says it's big business in Kenya, where influencers are cashing in ahead of the August 9th presidential election. They're renting out their pages and platforms to political candidates who can use them to spread their ideas, respond to criticism, or even start rumors about their opponents. With 12 million Kenyans using social networks, it's a gold mine. Creating and promoting a hashtag costs about $420 a day. That's a lot of money. Civil society organizations have warned of the threat posed by misinformation and hate speech. Now, of course, Kenya is no stranger to election meddling and election violence. Let's not forget, more than 1,100 people died
died during the 2007 post-election violence. Dozens more lives were lost in new election violence in 2017. As African countries like Kenya and the Democratic Republic of Congo and others gear up for crucial elections in coming months, what role will social media play? And could what happens online influence or impact the outcome of the vote? And so joining me now to discuss this is Milan Fayulu, a Congolese tech entrepreneur and founder of the digital platform Intel Congo. And with me here in studio is Vincent Makori. He is the managing editor of Africa 54, Voice of America's Africa Division Daily Television News Program. Vincent and Milan, thank you so much for joining me.
It's a pleasure.
Well, you know, Vincent, I'm going to start with you. Kenya's election in August could very well be one of the most consequential elections, not just in the East Africa region, but also on the continent. Where is this political contest going to be fought the hardest? I mean, will it be in public, meaning candidates having physical face-to-face contact with their constituents, or is this going to be fought hardest on social media?
Well, the Kenyan campaign is going to be multi-pronged. It's kind of a hybrid thing. You see, the politicians, the candidates, recognize the different constituencies that exist out there. And so about 50% of the registered voters are social media users, and a great number of these are younger people. But at the same time, you know, there are these others who don't have such a great or a big footprint on social media. And so the politicians like to go out there. They have messages for these different groups of people. But by and large, Kenyan politicians like to really be in touch with the people on the campaign trail. They enjoy the masses, you know, being on the podium and walking out the crowds.
Theater,
you know,
right?
The theater. And that is also a psychological game there, because that is what they want the opponents to see. That's what they want the supporters of the other guys to see, that they have this huge following out there. And that reaction and the exchange that they can, you know, have instantaneously is electrifying. But even more importantly, also, is what the traditional media does with this kind of you know, images when they see themselves on television, and you know, they are able also to communicate to other people, to people who may not have resonated with their message earlier, just by seeing the reaction of the crowds where they were addressing. So, yes, the social media is big and is going to play a big role, and they're going to try to fight hard on social media, but the traditional campaign style still is king.
That's very interesting. Milan, elections in the Democratic Republic of Congo sit for about 18 months from now, still some time away. And we do want to give our viewers a disclaimer here. Your father ran in the last election and will be running again in the coming election. But I want to talk to you about your expertise in sort of the tech world. And we're coming to you for analysis and as a little bit of an insider, giving us some insight into the mechanics of how this works. Now, political parties in the DRC, no doubt, probably already strategizing, working on campaigns behind the scenes at least. Now, from the work you do and from what you're seeing, are there signs that this is going to be a social media-driven election?
Yes, absolutely, to a certain extent. You just have to look at the numbers, right? So you've got about 21 million Congolese that are connected online. And out of that number, you've got about 98% that access social media primarily through their cell phones. So that gives you about 20 million of the population, or one out of five Congolese that's connected online. So that's a huge number of people. Debates are raging. You've got a number of influencers that are hired by political parties. And the truth is, on social media, fake news travels six times faster than the truth. So it's a huge battleground, and different types of factions will try to harness it in different shapes or form.
Vincent, social media has become such an integral part of electoral politics. But does it help or hurt democracy in the long run? I mean, does it actually make politics, especially in Africa, more inclusive and more accountable,
You well, think? Social media is a double-edged sword. Fayulu has actually pointed out, it's the speed at which messages or information on social media, travels is really fast. And so depending on how it is used, it's a viable tool. It can be a viable tool for nurturing democracy, for promoting democracy, for really helping people to engage in discourses that help to educate people on democracy and really strengthen the future of democracy in Africa. But on the flip side, if this is used in a negative way, it can also become a dangerous tool. And we've seen what can happen, and you're probably going to talk a bit more about that. It can become the bane of democracy in the future, in the sense that it has been used by strongmen, by dictators and others to really distort the whole concept of democracy, and sometimes to create the impression that, for example, especially in Africa, that democratic values that are really treasured in the West are un-African, and therefore start, disseminating information that help others to kind of pull back from what is supposed to be really the ideal pathway to a democratic culture in Africa.
Milan, bouncing off with what Vincent just said, what is your take? Does social media actually make our society, our electoral processes more inclusive and accountable?
Well, it's a difficult question, right? And there's a lot of research that points towards the fact that it's actually eroding democracy. You look at the U.S. Constitution, for instance. The founders knew that they had to put safeguards in place to control for human tendencies to be separate and create these factions I was referring to earlier. In social media, you've got a free-for-all. And the reality is, because there's a certain human psychology that has this tendency to move closer to fake news, then it creates a very dangerous environment where, bad actors tend to thrive. And so how much control can you get over that? That's the question, and that's the debate that we're facing currently with, the recent purchase of Twitter's and other developments in the sector.
And I would say that actually there's a way in which social media is slowly becoming helping African politics to be more inclusive and hold leaders accountable. This is because social media has created a public space where people can express their views, can actually express their outrage.
The public square.
Exactly. And leaders who you could never access in the past can now see what people are saying out there. Governments can be held accountable because people can discuss, what the actions of the government in the public square on social media. And some leaders have been compelled right now to actually have social media, platforms where they can respond to people's, reactions to things. So to some degree, yes, it can help. And it is slowly helping to make, politics a bit more inclusive, because more people are able to participate, whereas in the past they wouldn't have the opportunity. Social media is giving them that ability to interact with each other, but also to get so close to interacting with the politicians in their own country. So there is a place for that.
If I may interject here quickly, where this becomes a little tricky. So this is organic, right? And when it's organic and then people have a space to voice their opinions, absolutely, yes. But the problem that we're seeing today is social media gives players the ability to pay to get their voices heard. And this is when factions with the largest amount of resources are able to dominate the public discourse. And this is where you're seeing a lot of actors, leveraging social media influencers to get their message across. And, you've got like a number of certain things that are happening there that may be detrimental to this organic voice that would be beneficial to democracy.
Anonymity, I guess, gives you a certain level of guts to say what you want, air your views about, and just your dissatisfaction with situations. But what about actually on election day? In Kenya, we've got a whole new generation of voters in this election cycle, many of whom were, 10, 11, 12 years old with the 2007 election violence we saw. And in recent years, we've seen relatively low turnout in elections in places like Nigeria and South Africa. Low youth voter turnout, I mean, here. Has social media really been effective in the Kenyan context of actually mobilizing young people beyond chatter on social media to actually turn out at the polls on election day?
Well, in the past, in fact, in the last elections, social media played a big role in mobilizing the young people to come forth and vote. And it's as a result of that, what we're seeing today, there is voter apathy, especially among the young people. In fact, it's palpable. What is happening on social media now is even more young people, in fact, discouraging each other from participating in the elections. And the reason is they are not seeing the benefits of having voted certain people in, or even having voted the government in. Now, the government may be touting, you know, infrastructure, big, you know, big infrastructure projects. But for the younger generation, they're looking at how have they directly benefited in terms of employment. A great number of young, highly educated people have no jobs in Kenya. They live in poverty. They have seen their parents continue to stay the same way they were 5 or 10 years ago. So because of that, at the moment as we speak, there is so much voter apathy among the youth that even the efforts to mobilize them through social media doesn't seem to be as effective as in the past. They're engaging on social media, but they're not necessarily encouraging each other to participate in the upcoming elections.
Milan, I guess social media can get people to react in the moment, to get into a sort of political war of words ahead of elections. But generally speaking, how effective, in your view, is it in terms of driving young voters to the polls or to the ballot box on election day?
Well, the reality is the content that you see on social media affects your perception, right? But at the end of the day, there's the reality of your life. You know, how is your purchasing power? You have access to electricity. So when these factors come into play and then you realize that at the end of the day, your situation hasn't really changed, that is what ultimately motivates you to vote. So yes, social media does play a role, but I think, you know, like by and large, it is the real condition in the real lives that motivates voters to take action. And I think that we'll see that in the next election in 2023.
We're going to take a short break here. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We're going to talk about fake news, misinformation, and who the winners and the losers are in the digital space. I've got Vincent McCorry with me and Milan Fayulu. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Straight Talk Africa. I'm talking to Vincent McCorry and Milan Fayulu about the role of social media in elections in Africa. Now, we were talking before the break about driving young people out to the polls. But Vincent, misinformation, rumors, fake news, that's actually not new in political campaigning. Yeah. I mean, even before social media, we had other versions of that way before then. But what is social media bringing to sort of that dark side of the landscape that wasn't there before?
It's the reach, it is the spontaneity, because, you know, in the past, you know, you could spread a rumor, but this was dependent on word of mouth. So, you know, you have to keep, it has to keep moving from one person to another. Sometimes, of course, people have all this misinformation or disinformation on a podium in, you know, addressing a rally, but still it's limited to the people who are there. Or sometimes in mainstream media, there are some people would have, you know, stories that are totally distorted. But again, that's dependent on the amount of people watching that piece of news at that particular time.
Right, it's like
time.
Milan said, lies will travel six times faster.
Yeah. So right now, just it takes a click on that phone to have, you know, for millions of people across the country or even across the continent to get that information, that disinformation, that misinformation that can be extremely destructive. And we've seen what happens sometimes if it is something that can lead to a certain reaction. it can set up it can set on a fire. So it's not that rumors are new, misinformation is new. It is that social media has made it possible for it to be potentially harmful because of how quickly it can spread and how fast, not only how fast, but how many people it can reach within the shortest time possible.
Milan, speaking of what social media has made possible, who invests, especially during elections, who invests the most and who profits the most from the digital space during any election cycle?
Well, typically what you see is incumbents who have to protect, a bad record and who can't run on a strong record will have a tendency to invest the most. And we've seen that in 2018. As a matter of fact, Facebook, which is now called Meta, issued a number of statements pointing to the role, the negative role of social media influencers paid for by the government or by the current sitting president. So this is public information. So those are the people that will have a tendency to use social media negatively to spread fake news and rumors and misinformation about their records primarily.
And of course, young people are the influencers, right? At the same time, that's the constituency that candidates obviously want to reach. Vincent, will social media have, in your view, if you were to look into the future, do you think social media will say at the end of the day, will really have a significant impact on the outcome of the Kenyan election?
Well, it's not so much on the outcome. I mean, it's how the people will react to the outcome. So we've seen, what happens. It has happened in other countries where, for example, someone loses an election and using social media starts to spread this misinformation that he actually won the election. And we've seen those, especially in Kenya. It can be very, very destructive because, people can be incited through social media. People go in there and they try to explain exactly what they know happened, and people believe this as gospel truth. So what happens is that the social media may not influence what will be the outcome of the elections, but it will influence how people react to the results, once they come out.
Are there any guardrails at the moment to make sure that the worst does not happen again?
The thing is, believe it or not, I think the mainstream media has a big role to play here. It is where you can go to help people to really break down things and understand what really happens and what's the truth, what is fake. And of course, even the mainstream media has worked hard to kind of have a social media platform, and it can play a big role. Of course, along with the government, and other actors, there are activists out there who help to kind of spread the correct information, to check the facts. But mainstream media can play a very key role in helping to clear things up so that the misinformation, can be tossed aside for what is the truth.
Milan, speaking of thin lines or blurred lines, where do digital rights end and where does digital responsibility begin? I mean, how thin is the line here between the two, especially in a country like the DRC that has had repeated internet blackouts, but also where there's a chance that vitriol on social media could actually have violent, even deadly consequences? And are you seeing any signs in your country, or maybe lessons from any other African country, about keeping a check on making sure that online campaign rhetoric doesn't actually connect to real-world violence?
Well, that's very difficult, right? Because it's not like there is a regulator that can essentially put a lid on the behavior of people on social media. But I think it is the responsibility of influencers. It is the responsibility of thought leader to really think carefully about the content they put out there. And I think that, citizens who have a platform, citizens who are informed, as you rightly pointed out, the legacy media establishment has a duty to make sure that they're constantly, talking about these issues and making sure that the people are informed consumers of the information that is being delivered to them. Unfortunately, there's not a magic solution. It is really where citizenry comes into play, and you want to amplify wise voices.
Well, this is certainly a fascinating conversation. I wish we had more time to continue. But Vincent McCourry and Milan Fayulu, thank you both for your perspectives and for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having us.
And that is our show this week. Thanks to all my guests for joining me. And thank you to our affiliate stations airing Straight Talk Africa across the continent. And thank you, our audience, for always watching and always listening. I'll see you next time. Take good care. Goodbye.